The people working with these items became intimate with them. The longer the relationship, the easier it was to recognize the specialized traits each gadget possessed. The changes in configuration of the objects were not subtle. Round items become square, or a combination of shapes, and one end of a gadget could be geometrically different than the other end. Items that had the shape of a cube may have the shape of a blowfish the next day or next minute. They even changed shape while in use, which was a dire sight to witness. Some technicians passed out while watching an item mutate in the body of a person being experimented on. Witnessing an alien item swim just under the skin of humans was an experience none of the scientists ever became comfortable with. It brought to life the cliché "it makes my skin crawl." As bad as that was to witness, there was nothing more grotesque than watching the alien thing change geometrically while inside the person, especially if that person woke up while the transformation was in progress. The alien gadgets that entered the body were less than 2 inches long and looked like small carrots. Once they were placed on a living body, they entered through the abdomen. The end that burrowed into the skin elongates itself and then formed a tip that was finer than a hypodermic needle. Within seconds of placing the thing on the person's body, the thing inserted its tip into the skin, creating an incision the size of a pinprick. After the tip inserted itself, it sucked the remainder of its liquefied mass through the small incision. A comment from one astonished scientist who watched it: "At first it was a solid object. It then changed into a worm-like creature and began to enter into the body like a parasite. After the creature's tentacle anchored itself under the skin, the creature became balloon-like. What appeared to be solid instantly turned into a liquid, which was held in place by a thin membrane, like a water balloon. The creature transferred its liquefied contents to the inside of the human body, where it solidified. The creature then moved freely under the skin. The incision was small and there was no blood from it, and it healed at the same rate that a pinprick to the skin would. The creature, as it was called from that point on, came out of the body the same way that it entered, but not necessarily from the same location. The time that it spent inside the body varied from one individual to the next. What the creature did inside the body was not known, but the belief among the committee was that it was used as a kind of transport, carrying things into the body and probably removing things from the body. It was a blessing that in most instances, the subject who underwent this procedure was unconscious and barely holding on to life, but that was not always the case. There were a few episodes when the subject regained consciousness during an experimental procedure and was in excruciating pain from the alien object swimming inside of him. Fortunately for the scientists, the person associated his pain to his injuries and assumed that the technicians around him were doctors and nurses, since they were dressed up in the same white and green garb that the medical professionals used. The aliens apparently don't believe in anesthesiology, or the scientists had yet to identify the item that performed that specific function. From all the experiments that were done, the scientists discovered that when they anesthetized a person using the standard procedure used by doctors every day, the experiments were compromised. In each case, the alien instruments stopped what they were doing and went dormant. The alien gadgets acted as if the person had died. Because of that, the scientists concurred that the alien objects must operate on the electrical impulses of the body. When the cells are anesthetized, the neurons give off conflicting and inaccurate stimuli, making the task of the alien object impossible. Apparently, the alien objects use the cells of the body like a network of phone lines by which they navigate the whole body. From then on, the scientists did what the aliens probably did during abductions: zapped the person with the stun ray and paralyzed them. While under the alien paralysis, the person remained conscious some of the time. When he was conscious, he experienced the pain, as well as the terror that came from not knowing what was happening to him. But he could not interfere with the procedure since he was completely immobilized. Once the person was released from the paralysis, in every case, they had no recollection of what happened to them, or that anything out of the ordinary took place. Since most who were experimented on by the scientists were on their deathbed, The experimenters felt that they, the experimented on, had little to lose. In some instances, the victims had everything to gain. A number of the wounded and injured, whether from a war zone or from a car accident, recover from their wounds only because of the alien instruments and the experimentations that were done on them. When the committee was formed, the policy was that if any of the people working in that covert project became mortally ill or became damaged from an accident and were dying, that they would consent to being subjects for experimentation. The thinking of the committee was that no one should do to others what they themselves were unwilling to undergo. After carefully reviewing that proposal, many objections came to the fore. The most prevalent of those objections was outright terror. Committee members would not put themselves into a position where someday they might find themselves under the experimenter's knife, with alien creatures placed inside of them, and paralyzed so that their screams for help could not be heard by anyone, and so the proposal failed. Spontaneous combustion. After years of handling the alien tools, the tools became more intimate with their handlers, a kind of bond formed between the gadgets and the scientists. As bizarre as it sounds, the tools shared secrets with tenured scientists that they withheld from new or unfamiliar scientists. All the alien items performed more than one function. Discovering additional traits of alien stuff came easier to some than to others. Personality played a major role in the rate of success a technician was able to achieve. If his or her demeanor was friendly and they were slow to anger, they tended to be more successful than colleagues with short fuses and hot tempers. Ironically, those chosen for that program were usually from the type of personality, very aggressive and goal-oriented, unsatisfied if they did not get quick results. They were professionals recruited from the top ranks in their fields of expertise. But they were also people with integrity and tended to be beyond reproach. Members of the committee and those who professionals that worked under them were vigorously screened and needed to have the highest level of security clearance before they were hired. All of them were believed to be of good character and goodwill, with one exclusive objective, to serve their country. Still, those who hired them were mere mortals, with the mortal tendency to fail when it came to knowing what's inside an individual's soul, whether it be good or bad. But something as simple as an alien tool or gadget, knew completely the heart and mind of a man or woman, and allowed itself to be used accordingly. In other words, it was believed by the members in the committee that an evil person could not subvert the alien things, at least not the ones they were toying with. The alien things could not fall into the wrong hands as plutonium or germs used for germ warfare. The alien objects simply did not function when spite or malice was a motive, and often the gadgets turned on those who attempted such use. Nonetheless, no determination was made regarding whether the aliens were benevolent or evil beings. There was evidence indicating that they could be either one, or both. Most of the items that were cataloged and identified with performing a particular function were found to be beneficial to humans. Other items performed in ways that seemed purely wicked and contradictory to the earlier findings. One item that seemed evil was a 1-inch cube-shaped object that looked like it was made of the stuff diamonds are made of and had a small sphere the size of a pearl suspended in its center. The sphere pulsated with every color in the rainbow. It was a beautiful sight to see, was a common utterance of those who gazed upon it. But its beauty hid its dastardly purpose. Unlike many of the other alien objects, only one function was identified for that object. When it was placed on the chest of a person, the sphere left the cube and penetrated the chest cavity and entered the lung. It could be administered from the front or the back of a person, but it would not discharge into anything but a living human lung. It left no puncture wound or any other sign of entry on the body. It was never determined whether the sphere had mass or if it was a ball of photons or some other form of matter or antimatter. After it completed its task, it reappeared back into the cube. The whole episode lasted only 60 seconds. Not enough time to study what exactly was taking place in the lung. Once it penetrated the lung, the whole body went into a state of transmutation. The sphere appeared to use the oxygen in the lungs to accelerate its function. Exactly 52 seconds after the injection, most of the body vaporized into a whiff of smoke. On one occasion, all that was left was a few external body parts, fingers and toes. Interestingly, the scientists who were there when this first happened were not injured in any way, even though they were a few inches away from the body. It was a horrifying sight and supposedly was only performed twice. They only did it a second time so they could see what was taking place in the body after the injection. Spontaneous combustion had been a mystery for many decades and still will be for the general population. The committee now knows that it was not spontaneous, but caused for a purpose. That purpose remains a mystery. The device did not have a triggering mechanism. The cube functioned like all the other items from the alien ship. It was self-directing, and kept most of its secrets secret. How did the object know not to penetrate the lung of one of the scientists? It probably would have if it were placed on their chest. The scientists learned from the mistakes of their colleagues. Never come into direct contact with any alien object. Clothing made from any material, as well as ordinary gloves, seems sufficient protection from many of alien instruments. To function, the alien instruments often needed to come into direct contact with exposed living skin. Certain alien objects only operated inside the alien craft. When those gadgets activated, they triggered a corresponding response on the ship. An opening might occur, revealing hidden rooms or small mysterious spaces. Some of the rooms contained futuristic-looking surgical tables and equipment. Others were dark, empty spaces or voids that resonated with mystifying sounds and vibrations. Few scientists ever entered those rooms, and the few who did were never able to put into words what they found inside them. Some doorways and openings inside the ship remain hidden and unknown. There is no hint to where these spaces are, except when by accident or coincidence a scientist happened to walk by the area where the hidden room is located while in possession of the triggering alien device. Such devices seemed to be internally coded to open certain rooms and freaky spaces. One hidden room that was discovered by accident revealed a small chamber with a single seat in it. The seat was molded to support a human form. There were no cushions on the seat. The seat was made of the same material as the ship, a soft metallic substance. The chamber had a glow to it that was hard to describe, but one technician said that it had a heavy feel. The color inside the chamber was yellow, and the air thick like jelly. The chamber was the scariest space discovered on the craft mentioned in the documents. It gave all who saw it the chills. None of the scientists studying the chamber dared sit in the seat. The chamber was not much bigger than a nook in the wall, with just enough room for one seat and space for an average-size man. The scientists that were detailed to study the chamber submitted a request to the committee for a human guinea pig to place into the seat. They needed a living body to test a theory. They believed that once a person was placed into the chamber seat, the chamber would close, and only God knows what it will do to that person. How they came up with that theory wasn't mentioned. The unlucky victim who was placed into the chamber seat was a man in his 50s. He had no living family members or friends. He was a transient hit by a car. The search committee, which was in charge of procuring live human bodies for the scientists, found him through a network of government hospitals that were set up to provide that service. Hundreds of people with no known relatives end up in sanitariums every year, without anyone ever showing up to claim them. From that pool of the forgotten, the committee made use. The man procured for that experiment suffered massive injuries from the car accident. He was still alive, but barely, when the committee received him. Everything possible to save his life was done. When it was determined that he would die, his wounds were sutured and most of the bleeding was suppressed. He was delivered to the committee 2 hours after leaving the hospital and was placed into the chamber minutes after he arrived. The man could not sit up by himself and there were no straps to hold him in place. Apparently, none were needed. Once he was placed on the seat held him there as if he were a piece of metal in contact with a magnetic surface. Seconds after placing the injured man into the clutches of the alien seat, the remote unit that activated the opening of the chamber made an indescribable sound. The sound seemed to trigger the chamber to close. Once closed, The alien triggering device made other sounds and some kind of process in the chamber began. After a few minutes passed, no one really knows how long he was in there, but it didn't seem long. The remote device made more sounds and the chamber opened like a clam standing on its side. The man inside the chamber stood up and walked out of the nuke. There was no evidence of his wounds and his health appeared perfect. For an instant everyone there thought they had discovered the cure for all major injuries. But the euphoria was short-lived. As they watched the man, or what they had hoped would be a man, the man walked directly into another room in the craft. It was another mysteriously hidden room that revealed itself when the living human body approached it. They soon realized they were witnessing a nightmare and not a miracle. They watched the man walk past them without acknowledging any of them. The scientists could tell by the look in his eyes that something terrible had taken place. His eyes never wandered, but stared straight ahead as if he were a zombie. The room that he entered was much larger than the chamber that transformed him. The room was circular and had something similar to a bench seat that protruded from the curved walls. After the man entered the room, he sat on the bench and continued to stare with a blank expression towards the center of the room. The scientists tried speaking to the man, but he did not respond, although his eyes blinked at normal intervals and his breathing was normal. He was operating on autopilot. Whoever was piloting the body before he was put into the nook either bailed out or was kicked out. In either case, nobody was home. The body was given a complete physical and was found to be in perfect health. It wasn't until they x-rayed him that they found something abnormal surrounding his internal organs, mainly the stomach, intestinal tract and his kidneys. Since the body did not eat or drink, nor did it perform the normal bodily functions and still remained in top physical health, they surmised that the foreign object in the body was a kind of alien life support system. The alien organ kept the body alive, but what purpose could there be for a body with the lights out? The body stayed in that room for weeks, and then months. It did not age or deteriorate and remained in a dormant state, sitting upright, the whole time. The ship was like the fountain of youth. The scientists who worked in it felt like their aging mechanism was turned off. It was as if their biological clocks stopped and turned back when they entered the craft. Einstein's theory about time slowing down when mass approaches the speed of light did not apply, because the craft was stationary, unless it took off and they were flying around the solar system without knowing it. The same week that they discovered the zombie machine, as it was called, they brainstormed on what purpose the body could have. Ideas ranging from using it to clean up the lab to working around nuclear waste sites were not taken seriously by the majority in the committee. They considered doing an autopsy on the body and removing the alien organ that was sustaining it, but orders from higher up told them not to tamper with it. They were told to monitor the body to see if it was being incubated by the craft for a purpose that they could not yet grasp. What they did understand was that everything about the alien craft was self-directed. It seemed that they were only the to observer and were allowed to participate on a limited basis. After a few years had passed and the body remained the same, the scientists were given permission by the committee to perform a few experiments with it. Alien cover-up. Concern over the increasing media inquiries and the public's persistence to know more about the alien cover-up, which snowballed in the late 70s, forced the military to clamp down and make it virtually impossible for leaks about extraterrestrial craft to happen. Every document and report that was not essential to the committee was destroyed. A new procedure was adopted for the documents that were kept. The chronological order of everything that happened, every event that took place, was coded and the time sequence scrambled. The committee was not allowed to keep records and documents for more than a week at a time. It didn't matter what they were working on or whether they felt it significant enough to carry a particular project into the next week. At the end of each week, every note, folder and all documentation was removed from the possession of the committee. The committee could request information it required of past experiments and projects and get access to them with little difficulty, but they could no longer keep their own files as they had in the past. Security was made tighter due to the changing times, specifically because of the new legislation that went into effect in the decade of the 70s. the Freedom of Information Act, which was adopted in 1966 and amended to allow more information to be accessed in 1974, due in large part to the Nixon-Watergate scandal. Those who worked on the committee or under its jurisdiction were not allowed to bring anything to work with them. Nor were they allowed to leave with anything, not even a pencil. All the things they would need while at work was provided to them. Personnel independent of the committee were the only ones allowed to remove and provide office supplies and other miscellaneous items to the committee and their staff. The committee was not allowed to shred or destroy anything. Their trash was taken and incinerated by those same people. Everyone associated with the committee had to pass through a screening room before they could enter their assigned work areas or leave them. They had to leave clothing and all personal belongings, wallets, purses, etc., in the locker rooms. They wore a special garb made of paper, and it was collected from them whenever they left the building and burned. Everyone who left the building had to go through a body check. Their bodies were checked to make sure no one made notes or sketches on them. If someone was inclined to take information out of the facility, they needed to have a photographic memory. But, for the nature of what they were studying, it was highly improbable that even that would work. As one scientist told a colleague, easier it would be to emerge from a tornado with a handful of sand than to grasp what was in our labs and still make any sense of it once we left the building. It was difficult enough to communicate with colleagues about alien stuff, let alone someone who had no idea of what they were dealing with. For those reasons, many of them questioned the need for the strong security measures they had to endure. How could they possibly go out and prattle about the things they had discovered, when they themselves didn't comprehend what they had in their possessions? When they went home after work, it was as if they emerged out of a dream state. They were forbidden to discuss their work with their spouses, and they didn't. Not for fear they will be found out, they had no doubt they would be, but for the fear that their loved ones would think them insane. Part of the contract they agreed to when they signed on for the job was that they would be kept under constant surveillance at work and at home. The surveillance technique was not unfamiliar to government personnel, especially those who were adept at working under high security clearances. One system used microwaves as a means of surveillance. The system worked by bouncing microwaves off window panes. The microwaves detected minute vibrations on the glass surface caused by talking and other noises. Most vibrations are so small they cannot be detected by the naked eye. It doesn't matter how many conversations are going on at the same time or other background noise in the room with them. A computer synthesized the vibrations and recreated any or all the conversations that took place. Stored in a computer's memory banks are the voice imprints of everyone involved in the covert programs. With that information, the surveillance team can zero in on a particular member and listen to his or her conversation, whether they are in a car, office building, at home, or out on the town. In the weekly pep classes given by the committee to department heads, security was the main topic. At one of the meetings, a security officer from the CIA informed them that before the atom bomb was dropped on Japan, there were less than a dozen individuals in the world who understood the principles required to build that kind of device. To this day, few understand how nuclear particles can be manipulated to make a powerful explosive. Yet, the knowledge was leaked out, and in a short time many countries had nuclear capability. The CIA agent told the committee, "It is foolish to think that America is the only country to have an alien spacecraft in its possession." With that assumption, he told them, "It's plausible that the countries with alien knowledge, regardless of the extent of their extraterrestrial inventory, would use all their resources to acquire more of it." The fear that this information would fall into the hands of the general public was secondary. What the committee feared most was that a competing country would acquire that material. The general public was fed misinformation since the time the committee came into possession of the alien craft. This was done to confuse the public and at the same time make it more difficult for foreign agents to acquire reliable alien knowledge. Much of the misinformation about UFOs was leaked out by an agency that worked closely with the committee and not the committee. There was ambiguity in that area because those who controlled the direction of the committee members had given them specific instructions to withhold everything about the UFO phenomena from the public. And then they contradicted themselves when they gave orders to release certain true information via the underground for the purpose of misinformation. Some of the released material was accurate and truthful, but because of its bizarre nature, it was among the first to be denounced and rejected by the critics of the UFO phenomena. The campaign to discredit the entire civilian UFO research groups was funded on a small budget. The incredibility of beings from outer space or from other dimensions allowed the campaign to literally perpetuate itself and required little effort by the committee. Power of the intangibles. Though there are thousands and possibly millions of people who believe without doubting the existence of extraterrestrials, there are millions who don't believe. Likewise, a large part of humanity does not believe in anything, especially if it can't be seen, tasted, or touched. Tangible things are what life is all about to the vast majority of humans. Cooks who talk about miracles and the nuts who see little green men with big eyes should be locked up. With prevailing public opinions such as those, the committee should not need to take many security measures at all. Comments found in a document. Security measures are primarily used to keep information from falling into the hands of agents from other governments. Governments who not only believe in the strange and unexplainable, but also spend large sums of money and time gathering up as much of that hokey-pokey stuff as they can get their hands on. Nations and people who are caught up in the tangible things of the world miss out on a whole lot of magic and mystery, the only real stuff in life. During the 1970s, committee members became hungry in their search for answers. Not necessarily because of increased demands from higher-ups, but from a strange and exasperating craving to learn more about extraterrestrials. It was a feeling all the members held jointly, as if they were on the brink of a major discovery concerning the craft. There was no hard evidence for the mass craze other than there were periods that no one wanted to go home at the end of the day. They were working themselves to death in the quest for more understanding of the alien mystic and only wanted more. In the meantime, vocal UFO groups persuaded a few in the media to put pressure on certain congressmen to shed light on the UFO cover-up. The wolf of disclosure was beating at the door. Would the door be kicked down before the committee was able to cull the pertinent information they needed or wanted from the craft? There was a lot of concern about the possibility of disclosure and them losing their edge. If the world found out about such projects and other secret projects, it would be over for them and perhaps mayhem for the country. However, they had little to fear. Some politicians did pound their fists and vowed to get to the bottom of that conspiracy, but only for show, to placate that small element of their UFO not constituency. Normal Americans were uninterested in the UFO fantasy, as they believed it to be. Most politicians know there is a limit to the fruits of their inquiries and don't expect to get factual answers on certain topics, UFOs being one of those topics. They did manage to get the Air Force to release some files, albeit insignificant dummy files that were created specifically for that purpose. Politicians know, or should know, they are only receiving junk, but they don't care because it makes them look like they are trying to get to the truth. All democracies have limits, and the United States, with the best version of democracy in the world, will never reach the point where the common people have access to what goes on in government backrooms. Nevertheless, there is always a firebrand freshman from the House of Representatives or in the Senate who will come along and try to kick the door down, believing they will expose the conspiracy behind UFOs. But within a week or two, or perhaps a few months, like all the rest before them, they emerge with the proverbial tail between their legs, no longer looking for a fight and gladly taking the crumbs of deception that was thrown to them originally. There are things in the real world that the general population need not know about. Extraterrestrials is one of them. A quote from a memo that was sent anonymously to one senator who tried and failed to get information about the UFO conspiracy. The committee as a whole was painfully aware that they possessed secrets and knowledge that they and humanity were not ready to accept, and it was a real dilemma for most of them. Many involved with the program, if they had to do it over again, would not. Unfortunately, Leaving the program was impossible, they knew too much. Ironically, if they were allowed to leave with no consequences for doing so, most would not. Leaving would not remove the knowledge of the aliens from their minds, and living a normal life with the things they knew was not possible.